Now it gives me great pleasure, and let's give a big welcome to Candace M. from Los Angeles as our main speaker.
Encore, Candace! Oh, excuse me, premature. Candace Moore, alcoholic. Thank you guys so much for allowing me to come and participate. My dear friend Annette for inviting me. And Joe for, it really was a fabulous talk. It's not better than my talk, but it's a fabulous talk nonetheless. Like a baby fabulous talk. And welcome to our friends here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this is just, my friend Ralph W. always says, AA is the best step I will ever take from the cradle to the grave. And that for me is the deepest statement I have ever heard. You're saying of all the promotions we will have, the kids and the special moments and marriages and divorces, you know, you're saying of all the beautiful moments that AA, happily divorced people are like, yay, that Alcoholics Anonymous is the best step we're ever going to take from the cradle to the grave. And that has been my experience, right? Everything I have is as a direct result of the sober breath I draw. I don't want to get up if I can't be sober. I don't want to be here, you know? And so I think of any challenge in my life, I just want to go through it sober. And I remember when that was challenged at one time because of my conduct. And so just so grateful to be here. My sobriety date is August 16th, 1995. It's the only date I've ever had. And what that means is that over the years I've been here, many things have had to change in order for my date to remain the same. I've had to come and be willing to surrender behaviors and belief systems that were not conducive to me staying with you continuously. And I remember, you know, getting sober, that was just so different. It was like a whole different world. It was just a different world. And so when I got sober, I was 96 pounds. We aren't 96 today. You know what I mean? And that's why I'm wearing a peplum. You know, you just camouflage. And so, you know, the funny thing is I got sober at 28. I'm 52. And I looked older then than I do now. But in my 20s, I've always been like a size 4, right, designer size 2. And yet in all pictures, I was always sucking my stomach in, sucking it in. And now that I should suck it in, I don't want to. And so so anyway, 96 pounds, and I would have like a Snickers bar every 3 or 4 days, like an energy bar, you know, because I was very hungry. and so when I got sober, I was missing my front tooth. What happened? I shared an opinion and it wasn't supported. That's what happened. But I never stopped talking. And when I got sober, I didn't have a strand of hair on my head because when I dream, things join me and they all live in my hair. And I remember telling my friend, I said, there's something in my hair. She was visibly alarmed. She leaned back. She asked me, how do you know? I said, because while we were talking, they ran from this side to that side. So she never gave me direction per se. She shared information that I embraced. She said, you know, rubbing alcohol will sterilize anything. So at no time did she say, go to the store, purchase a bottle of rubbing alcohol and pour it all over your scalp. But I know that it was implied. And so so that's what I did. And for me, you know, I'm so grateful every time we read the 12 traditions. I take my girls through all 12 steps as outlined in our book. We go through the book. When it says to take a step, we take a step. When they are on their inventory, they have 1 month to do an inventory, a resentment, a fear, and a sex inventory. And if they don't want to do it, then they don't want me as a sponsor. Right? And after we go through all 12 steps, then we go through all 12 traditions individually. And so I remember when I got, when I was still out there, when I was doing the rubbing alcohol treatment, what happened is because I was a supporter of the traditions before I even knew what they were. And that means we took a group conscience. And I told everything and everyone in my hair, I said, look, I know you're up there. I know you're up there. You can stay, but I'm going to sterilize you. And so what I would do is I would just pour rubbing alcohol all over my hair. And in the beginning, it was very soothing, like a meditation. And then after a while, they became immune to it. They started to get aggressive. And so I had to get aggressive. I took a pair of scissors. I cut off all of my hair. But new friends, half measures avail us nothing. And so I took a shaver, and I shaved it all to the scalp. And I would wear T-shirts on my head as if they were fashionable turbans, making my own statement. And it was quite the vision, I can assure you. And so I know what you're thinking. I know what you're thinking, right? Especially this section. You're like, ooh, bald-headed and toothless. Ooh, right?
Yeah.
And the beauty is that when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous in that condition, you're safe because they don't want what you have. You know what I mean? But as demonstrated tonight, there's always one. There's always one, and he will work with you. And, you know, they know you have potential, right? And they want bragging rights when you get it together. They're going to be like, you know, I knew her when she didn't have a tooth. You know what I mean? And so the thing about that is this. For me to be 28 years old, an adult woman, that's the sum total of every effort I had in a committed relationship with alcohol. And to take it a step further, if I came into Alcoholics Anonymous looking like that, you already know how I was living. There are things you don't even have to say because people just know. And the reason I love Alcoholics Anonymous and the reason I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous is because when I came in, you didn't say, don't sit here. You said, sit here. Someone else would ask me, do you have a ride home? Someone else would say, we're going to eat. Come with us. Not, do you have money? Come with us. Alcoholics Anonymous is a magical, special, sacred space, you know? And I was just thinking of a bottom I hit. It's interesting because I was talking at this meeting on Thursday, and this newcomer who was leading the meeting, he was 2 weeks sober. And when I sat down after my talk, he kept looking over at me. He had given me a hug. He kept looking at me. He's like, I'm going to put a ring on your finger, right? And he was young. It was a young people's meeting, and he was gay. It was a young people's meeting. And he was fabulous and flawless, actually, but certainly not like I looked at 2 weeks sober. And so then before I know it, he like takes this ring off and he puts it on me. And so I just keep wearing my ring because there was something about his spirit that touched me. Like something about his spirit touched me and I felt very maternal. You know, and like my ovaries were flipping. I was just like, oh, I just want to protect you. And so I'm in that space. I'm hormonal. It's a lot of things happening. So anyway, I remember when I hit my bottom sober, and that's important because I believe we all have a second bottom, right? And that's the bottom that's going to define if I really want to stay here. And so what happened is I had fallen in love, and I have been in many, many relationships. I was 6 years sober. I've been in many, many relationships, and someone was always saying, I love you. And because I'm a team player, I would say, I love you too. You know what I mean? But I was typically lying. And so this time, I meant it like I loved. And the thing is, it didn't look like I thought love would look. It didn't feel like I thought love was supposed to feel. It was verbally and physically abusive, and I cried a lot. I cried a lot. And so my sponsor, Gloria Decker, who raised me in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, Gloria was the love of my life. And she was frightened for me because she saw what was going on. And she said, you know, Candace, you have to leave this relationship. You are living drunk but talking sober. You have to leave. And I said, I can't leave. This is my soulmate. And what is so heartbreaking is that 6, 7, and 8 years sober, the length of time I was in that relationship, that's what love still looked like. Love still looked like abuse, deception, right? Demeaning. And I remember she became insistent that I leave. And I'll tell you what I thought. I don't mind telling you because I know you'll get it. I remember thinking she was jealous. You know what I mean? I remember thinking she clearly doesn't understand our passion. And so so when I was 2 years sober, my first home group was the Bellflower Big Book group. And when I was 2 years sober, Gloria and Bob, Gloria at this time, when I am going through this, was 29 years sober. Bob was 29 years sober. He had 3 months longer than she. They had been married 39 years. They knew each other 7 years before that. They had been childhood friends. They had been in other relationships but had gotten together. They had children, and they were low-bottom drunks. And that means that their children had a front seat to the alley of alcoholism. right? But as a direct result of the principles and traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, their relationship had been healed to a state where they didn't have to explain what love was. They demonstrated it in the manner in which they treated each other. And so I remember being 2 years sober, and those are like the formative years, you know? And so whatever my sponsor does, I'm looking. And she and Bob, we were having the dance, and she and Bob were on the floor, and she was gazing up at this man like a starry-eyed teenager. And he was looking down on her with the utmost tenderness. That is love. Love doesn't demean, it doesn't make you second guess your worth. Love inspires, it expands, it renews, it is foundational, it affirms. Yet when this woman who had given me nothing but solid direction wanted me to walk away from a relationship in which I was forfeiting my dignity, fear will come out as arrogance. Arrogantly, I said, I don't want to leave. The fear, as revealed in inventory, was, I think if I leave, no one will love me again. And so I remember I decided I could no longer talk to her about this relationship because she was tripping. And so I decided to skip the middleman and go to the source, right? And so that's what I did. Spirit, spirit, give me a sign. Should I stay in the relationship? The police came. Oops, not that sign. And, you know, I remember when the police started coming and the relationship went in the toilet, right? And so at that point, it was over. And we did what anyone sitting here would do. We got engaged. And so, you know, we were engaged for 6 days, but they were long days, like in dog years. And I remember when it was over, when I couldn't take it anymore, I was throwing up the last 3 months of that relationship every day. I was 15 pounds underweight. I couldn't keep my food down. I remember that. Love doesn't look like that. And I just couldn't handle it anymore. And so I took the ring off my finger and I just felt like I wanted to die. I felt like I wanted to die. And I remember being angry at my sponsor because she was right and I needed her to be wrong. I was angry at spirit because my third step was more of a bulleted list of demands. And then I would throw in, your will not mine be done, you know, to appear humble and all. And so I remember being angry because I'm like, you know, I'm never going to be in love again. Look at how long it took me to finally find love. Why would you do this to me? Why would you do this to me? Imagine my shock and delight when 6 days later I was in another relationship. And so, you know, sometimes you just got to let the healing begin. And when I got into the second relationship, because I know there's no judgment in the rooms, when I got into the second one, they were already in one. All the judgment. You just heard it right there, like a swell of it. And so, yeah, it is tricky. It is tricky, that overlap. And so I remember the police coming back to my house. I remember losing all the women I sponsored. And I remember the amount of pain. And pain is indistinguishable. It wasn't that pain versus this pain. It was just all pain. And Gloria had a rare lung disease, and she was fighting for her life. So she was often in the hospital. And so when I would talk to her, I didn't want to burden her with what was going on because I'm sober long enough, right? You start playing all those mind games. But the book tells me a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. I can't run me by me. And so I am in this relationship, and it's crazy. And I remember one night just being in torment. There's nothing more painful than to be in love with one person and lay down with someone else, sober. And I just looked over at my partner, and I asked, if I drink, will you leave? And they said, no. I asked, if I drink, will you drink with me? And they said, yes. There is nothing, nothing they wouldn't have done to keep me in a relationship. And I'll tell you, because sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous, people have gotten upset when I share that, oh my God, you know, we get sanctimonious when we get sober. Oh my God, I can't believe you would ask another alcoholic, you know. And I just say, I understand, sugar, pray for me, you know, because I suffer from the disease of alcoholism. It's not a disease of the pretty. It's a disfiguring, distorting, debilitating disease. And my thinking changes. When I'm not grounded in principles, I am grounded in self. So my thinking reverts back to, if I'm thirsty and you're here, good manners and all, it would be rude of me not to offer you a drink. That's how deep and wicked this disease is. The reason my sobriety date has never changed, and I define sobriety as I don't take anything at any time that affects me from my neck up. That means, to be clear, that I don't drink near beer because I'm not near sober. And I don't smoke marijuana with or without a doctor telling me I can. And I stabilize my mood with the steps. And that's a personal decision, right? And so it was a sober household. That's why my date has never changed. We just simply went to sleep. The next day I got a hold of Gloria and I told her what happened. And she said, Candace, you don't have the right to jeopardize someone else's sobriety. Stop quoting the book and start living by the principles. Which I thought was rude. Anyway, and so I asked her, you know, well, what do I do? And they're so over the top. Get away from them. Like, hello. You know, and so I ended that relationship. That person drank a week later. It's unfortunate. But the reality is this. If I can't get you sober, and I have sponsored women that I would give my entire heart to see them stay sober, and they've not. So if I can't get you sober, I cannot get you drunk. I've heard people say I went out behind my relationship. That's absurd. I am far too self-centered to drink over anyone. When I was thirsty because of my conduct. I hear a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know, you know sometimes where they come from. One of the things I've heard often is if you forget your last drink, you're doomed to repeat it. I don't know because I remember my last drink. But something that should be shared that is not, and that is your conduct, the way you are living sober, can start to outweigh the pain of your last drunk. It was my conduct that made me thirsty. I was living one way and talking another, right? And so I remember being so devastated and the obsession to drink on me. And it was painful because when I got sober, it was lifted. I knew people who still had the obsession to drink and I empathized, but I couldn't identify with it until 8.5 years sober when it came back and it felt like I was living in hell. It felt as if someone were just peeling my skin off while I was awake. That's how it felt. And I remember when I went back through the work, Alcoholics Anonymous has always saved my life, always. It has never failed me. People have failed me. Sponsors have failed me, right? There are friends. I thought we would be friends forever. We're no longer speaking. Sponsors I put on a pedestal without their permission, they're no longer my sponsor, right? Relationships I thought we would be in rocking chairs in our 80s, it's been over for years. But Alcoholics Anonymous has always been consistent. And so when I went back through the work, you know, and I'm so grateful that Joe talked about the inventory, the resentment, the fear, and the sex inventory is outlined in the book. And so I just want to give an example because sometimes I think new people need to have an example. And so I'm making this up, so don't run with it. Okay, so typically when I'm in untreated alcoholism, my natural state is column 2 of a resentment inventory, right? Which is what they did. You know what I mean? So a resentment inventory is column 1, who, right? Person, place, or thing. Column 2, what they do, right? Column 3, what does it affect? Column 4, where have I been selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and frightened? So let's walk through it. I am pissed off at Tiffany. Oh, what'd she do, right? She keyed my car. Oh, okay. We can all stop there because I feel I should get a posse together and we should character assassinate Tiffany forever, right? But since I said I wanted healing, okay, I'm going to go on to column 3. It affects my self-esteem. And when my girls are doing an inventory, they do an extended inventory, meaning they're going to list everything and they're going to write it out because we need to be clear. Self-esteem is too vague. I need to know how it is affected, right? So it affects my self-esteem. She doesn't think much of me or she wouldn't have keyed my car. It affects my security. She's a nut job. I don't feel safe. It affects my ambition. I wanted us to be like sisters. It affects my personal relations. I thought we were best friends. It affects my sex relations. I don't feel sexy when my car is keyed. And so, and then column 4, right? Ask me, where was I to blame? And so I'm going to sum it up in the interest of time. I slept with her partner. She found out and keyed my car. Oh, okay. So now we've entered a different sphere, right? Because when I started off, I was all pissed off and I was all justified and I've rallied my friends together and they're like, yeah, 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 Tiffany. But now, you remember in column 3, I wanted us to be like sisters? What sister would betray someone like that? What type of woman, knowing what it feels like to be hurt, would do that to another woman, whether you like them or not? Right? That's why I don't want to go through inventory, because it's unpleasant. It says it's a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. I like to live in the intent, what I meant to do. You want to hold me all like accountable. You know what I mean? And particular. Ugh. And so, and then I remember going into the fear inventory. And so I do fear workshops all over the country, because when I went through the inventory again at 9 years sober, it was different than I had done. My initial fear inventory was my fears, why I had them, in a prayer. Too vague, didn't work, still had them. It was never touched, right, at a core level. But when I go through the book, there's three columns. The fear, why I have it. Last column, because they go, why don't see the third column? It says we let God demonstrate through us who he would have us be. That means if this fear is removed, what would it look like? When I started putting that on paper, my entire life changed. Because why am I taking step three if I don't think the fear is really being removed? And I had to confront, I'm not talking about I'm afraid of spiders, which I'm deathly afraid of spiders, but I'm talking about I'm afraid I'm too damaged to be loved, too ugly to be loved, too used up to be loved. This is 9 years sober. How is this not touched? I'm sponsoring, I'm flying around, I'm doing all these fabulous things, and on paper, these are my fears. And so I had to go through each and every one of them and answer, if it were removed, what would that look like? What would that feel like? Right? So that I could get clear and start coming from that place, because until I have that information, I can only draw on what it was like. And I'm staying in that space, Anna. And it changed my life is what it did. And then I went into the sex inventory. Where did I arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness, and doubt? Where do I not? I do a lot of game playing when I'm in relationships because I'm insecure. And I need you to prove that you love me. Where was I inconsiderate? When I said hello. You know what I mean? You thought we were going to be partners. I get it. But no, sugar, I just need you to be cute, be freaky, and have some money. That's it. And so, you know, back in the day. And so, you know, now I have values. Anyway, so, and then it asked me, whom did I hurt? That's painful. Who has been affected? Are there children that are watching this? When I sponsor women that have underage kids, the first thing we talk about is you don't get to drag your boyfriends in the house when you have underage kids. That is not okay. That's not okay. But I know him. No, you don't. He said you were cute. Now he's in the house. We're not doing that. So when I am in inventory, it's important for me to, are there friends that were so worried about my behavior, they're neglecting their own families to care for my safety? And that's happened. The thing I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is it always meets me where I am. It speaks to me directly. And what happens when someone's telling me the truth and I've been used to people lying to me, I often think they're being rude, right? The book talks directly to me and it sees where I am. We've gone through this process and it reaches its hand out with the next question and it says, stand up, Candace, come with me. The next question is a game changer. It asks me, what could I have done differently? What? You mean I can do something different and not just run my mouth about it like I did? So that means when someone who's in a relationship slithers over to me, and when I'm in low self-esteem, I think disrespect is a compliment, right? So when they slither over to me, I get to say, no, thank you. I'm not dishonoring myself today. I didn't know that a woman like me got to say, no, thank you. And I didn't know that I didn't know. And then it asked me to list my ideals. Oh, man. At 9 years sober, I had been here and I had seen couples, healthy couples. I had seen Gloria and Bob and the way they loved each other and other friends. And so I just went for it. And the first thing on my list was, I want a partner I can pray with. If we can't pray together, we can't lay together. Who knew that was ever going to be of importance to a woman who had been where I'd been and did the things I did? I didn't even know I got to ask for that. I didn't know that it would have any significance, and it is non-negotiable. When I say it is the first thing on my list, that's exactly what I mean. And I had a lot of other values that I wanted that person to embody, and I was told, then you have to bring everything you want from that individual. I was like, where is that in the book, right? Because I'm a 97.3 type of gal. You bring 97%, I bring 3%, and that will be borrowed. You know what I mean? And so what started happening is I started to grow into the woman I wanted to be. For my birthday, my belly button birthday, which was in April, went to a super nice restaurant with my boss and a client, and the way that it was designed, there were like little mirrors, and I kept catching reflection of myself in the mirror. You know, you want to be engaged in what they're saying, but like, there I am in this mirror. And I was like, hey, you know what I mean? I was like, you ever just see yourself sometimes and you're like, look at you all grown up and everything, eating with the right fork. You know what I mean? It's a big deal. Because it wasn't always like that. For some people, maybe it was, but it wasn't always like that. I don't ever want to forget. I believe when I forget, it's not a big deal to do it again. You know? And so my life is different. I remember the movie Jerry Maguire being really popular. And after it, like, I wish we would examine what things actually mean as opposed to jumping on the bandwagon. Because everyone started saying, you complete me. Like, that was the thing. You know what I mean? You can't complete me, sugar. I'm already whole, divine, and splendid, right? You can only compliment what's here. But I have to get clear as to who I am, or I'll accept anything. So Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like amazing. It's amazing. I was sitting in the car with a woman I sponsored last night. I was dropping her off, and we were going through the book. We're just at the beginning of going through this process. And I'm like, how come there's nothing written on your page? You have highlights, but how come there's no, because I have a conversation with my book. It's a relationship. Why is there nothing? I said, I think you're detached. You think so? Yeah, I do. And I said, when we finish it, this chapter, right, I want to see some interaction. But just the process of having gone through it earlier, before we got, like, she just sat in the car. She didn't get out. So I knew she needed to talk, you know, and then you see the tears starting, right? And so we ended up talking in my car for like an hour. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it just opens up, it just slowly, like a little peek. You peek your head in. Is it safe? Yeah, come on in, right? And so that I get to be a safe space for someone. My grandmother raised me when I was little, and she loved me and I loved her. She was my everything. And I was terrified of the dark, so at night I slept next to her and I would watch her as she slept. And at some point I told myself that I had to pace my breathing to match her breathing, because if she died, I wanted to die with her. So when she inhaled, I would inhale. And when she exhaled, I would exhale. I did that every night until I fell asleep. My mother is an alcoholic. She's an alcoholic by her own admission. She was very young when she had me. She wasn't done doing what she needed to do as an alcoholic woman. I didn't understand it then, but I understand it now. My mom was 17 when she had me, so she was 16 when she was pregnant. I'm not emotionally developed, so there's no way she could be emotionally developed, and she's under the lash of alcoholism. So my grandmother raised me. But what would happen is my mother would get drunk. She'd call my grandmother up, make some incessant demand. I knew it was my mom on the other line because my grandmother would grip the receiver real tight and that vein would pop out right in the center of her forehead, indicating that my mother was being unreasonable, right? And so she'd look at the phone and say, absolutely not. Slam the phone down. A short while later, my mother would pop over and shoot out all of the windows. Let us be clear, I didn't want what she had, right? And so there are other cousins and uncles in my family who suffer from the disease of alcoholism. It's not why I'm an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic because of what happens to them when they drink. I'm an alcoholic because of what happens to me when I drink. I don't know when I start drinking where I'm going to end up, but I can assure you there will be movement, right? So this disease manifests in my family through a lot of violence. A lot of the members favored shooting. I favored stabbing, tomato, tomato. And at some point when we all got together, the police were gonna be present. So holiday at my mom's house. My mother's a big gal, big bone gal. And she cooks from scratch. I don't, I'll tell you why. Because it's overrated, that's why. So if my mother's cooking, I have to go, but it's akin to going to any length in light of what's gonna happen. Everything I say, preface it by she's getting her drunk on, right? So I go over, and this is back in the day. I knew we were okay. I mean, she's drinking, but by the music that was playing, I knew we were in a good space. So she's listening to the Spinners, the Temptations, right, the OJs. It's okay. It's all right. It's all right. And then later on, the aromas wafting throughout the house. And now she's moved into the Diana Ross and the Supremes juncture. Okay, okay. So she's good, but she's getting a little feisty. A little feisty, yeah. Hours later, she's been drinking. It's dusk. So now she's getting a little melancholy. We've entered the Sam Cooke juncture. Because by the time nightfall hits, she's going to the blues. Billie Holiday and B.B. King, run, right? Once she starts getting into the blues, she's thinking about who left when she thought he was going to stay. She's thinking about how life has treated her unfairly. She's going to start crying. But she's not going to cry for a long time. She's going to get pissed off and want to fight. I don't want you to think her rude. You will get a meal. You just may limp out with it. You know what I mean? And so I'm in junior high. My friends are drinking and having a good time. I want to have a good time. But it's simple in the beginning. But there's just that one thing. When I start drinking, I cease to care about you. I feel too close to you. I can't lie. I don't care about you before I start drinking. Now that I've taken the drink, I'm more inclined to share with you that I don't care about you. There we go. So, you know, I have to. Don't get your feelings, sir. We're being honest. And so I have to ask that you resist the urge of pulling me to the side and telling me how I have wronged you, allegedly, right? You know, it talks about me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate seemingly, that's a tricky little word, right, without provocation. I'm not just mashing toes. I'm a high heel stiletto wearer from way back. But the thing is this, because we talk about the difference between a defect of character, right, and a natural emotion. So it says that a defect of character is just a natural instinct that far exceeds its intended purpose. Now, it's important that I go through the work, because if I'm listening to someone who just wants to critique every move I make, they're going to give me misinformation. Like if I'm angry, they're like, oh, you must not be working a program. Well, that's absurd. If I slap you, then I'm not working a program, right? Because there's one is a natural emotion, one is a defect of character. I'm just giving examples here. And so, you know, I remember working for a record label, and when they hired me at the label, they hired me as a receptionist. But you know what? I'm a visionary. And some people say delusional, but I say visionary. And so technically, yes, they did hire me as a receptionist, but really I felt they were grooming me for CEO. And so I would always walk around assuming the posture, you know, and I started to get promoted. So I've had the absolute privilege of promoting multi-platinum artists. And this was way before reality shows and people were telling their lives. You know what I mean? It was a very exclusive industry at that point. And so the more I got promoted, the more I got loaded. There was an old timer who would always say, alcohol gave me the wings to fly and then it took away the sky. I am not here because I never lived my dreams. I'm here because alcohol dictated what I would do, when I would do it, how it would look, and when I would resume doing it. If you would have encountered me, you would have thought I was absolutely the most self-assured, confident individual you would ever come across. But basically every day I felt like a little kid playing dress up. Every day, all the time, I was terrified that you guys were going to find out my mother was an abusive parent who lived in South Central, and you were going to come to me and say, Candace, you're not one of us. You don't belong here. Leave. That's alcoholism. It lives in fear, lack, limitation. You're not going to make the grade. The rug is going to be pulled out from underneath you any moment. I'm so grateful to the members of Alcoholics Anonymous that have taught me to train my feet. My dear friend Larry T. always says, train your feet. I had to shut my mouth and train my feet. To take all 12 steps, to learn how to take contrary action, right? A little snack from earlier. And so, thank you, Annette. And so, during this time, I remember my grandmother died, and when I found out, she had already been buried. And she had already been buried because I was so busy living in illusions, delusions, and facades that I wouldn't go back to see her. I was trying to create my life and just divorce myself from everything else, right? So this is a woman who had raised me, and I'm sure while she was dying, she must have asked for me. You know what I mean? What do you do with that? Because there are no steps for me to write. I don't have a sponsor to run things by. I'm going to get drunk is what we're going to do. And a short while later, I just couldn't reconcile anything, and my head was telling me that I was living and working in a world built on make-believe, and it told me to get real, which I don't know how to do. I just know how to get drunk. And so I remember walking away from that industry, just walking away from my career that I had worked quite hard to. 4, and I was still young, and so I was cocky because I was very insecure. There's a difference between confidence, right? And I'm now out there, I'm on my own, I'm used to having a label behind me, and now it's just me, but I'm not a periodic, I drink period. So I had to make a decision. I made a decision to step out there and market myself in exchange for a drink. I refer to this as the public relations phase of my development. And, you know, when I stepped out there, the investors felt very good about the product. And they were willing to pay top price and invest heavily and reputedly, right? But, you know, some people are so snooty because when you start losing your teeth, well, what happened is my stocks plummeted. And, you know, it's like one day you're shopping in Neiman's and the next you're in Walmart. You know what I mean? And I remember talking in Connecticut at a conference, and I shared this story because I only have one story. So this woman comes up to me after, and she's all emotional, and she's like, I really connected with your story. And I'm like, oh, thank you. And she goes, there's just one thing. Well, what is it? And she goes, I work at Walmart. You know what I mean? And so I said, it's okay. Walmart's a good American store. And then I gave it some more thought, and I said, but it ain't Neiman's. Get out of here, right? So anyway, talk to your sponsor. So I, did you say 925? Okay. So I am out there, and I don't take care of myself, right? Because I'm up 8, 9 days straight. And I look like I shared with you. And then I got pregnant. I don't want to be the type of woman that drinks when they're carrying a child. I mean, I may have done all this other stuff that's just horrible, and I'll be ashamed of for the rest of my life, but I'm not doing that until I do it. And I remember when I found out I was pregnant, I made a decision to terminate that pregnancy. And I know it's a really hot topic right now. I'm not going to weigh in on my opinion. I'm going to share this. Even though I loved my grandmother, when I was little, there were men who would come in the house who were fond of children in a way that's not okay. And they were fond of me a lot. And so because of who I have become as a woman under the lash of alcoholism, I couldn't guarantee that a child in my care would be safe, and I didn't want to risk it. And so there was never, well, why don't you just not drink? That's never an option. On every form I saw, not drinking was just not listed. It wasn't a box to be checked. That's like saying, why don't you just not breathe? I mean, that's just insane. I have to breathe. And so when I made the decision to terminate that pregnancy, I learned via every news station, radio station, and TV station that a member of my family had been arrested for raping, torturing, murdering, and dismembering my 8-year-old little girl cousin. And the person who did that is my mother. And so I can't describe the moment. I can't describe the moment. It's horrific, doesn't really do it justice. It's like I just don't understand it. But I do know this, that I'm the oldest of 3. I have a younger brother and sister that were raised with her. And so the things that they suffered, I don't believe in the term, what's it called? Child Protective Services. Yeah. I don't believe in that because it should never have gotten here. And she's killed 2 children, not 1. I was supposed to testify against her next Friday to keep her from coming out, her parole hearing. And I don't know what happened, but I called and they said she waived it. So for 5 years, because I testified against her 5 years ago to keep her from coming out. And they're bringing charges for the second murder, who was actually committed before the first murder. How does this happen? But I'm on the streets. There's a baby in my belly. I'm under the lash of alcoholism, and my mom is a murderer. Do you know what I mean? I remember thinking anything of value, worth, or beauty is not afforded to someone like me. I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing worse than looking pretty and feeling ugly. I've had to do a lot more than just come in and go to meetings. What we are talking about tonight are things lipstick can't fix. I feel for anyone who would sit in a 12-step meeting and not take the 12 steps. I had no idea that I could have the life I have. I have a big life. I have an amazing life. People always hear this and they go, oh, I'm so sorry. No. I don't live in pity. My case is not different. What I get to do by being a sober, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous is I get to break the cycle of insanity. When I went into labor, I had been up getting loaded for 3 days straight. And I remember being in the hospital and they put this thing on my stomach and I could hear my child's heartbeat and I just started praying that my child would be okay. I'm crying and I'm praying. That is step one when you're overwhelmed. It says our problems pile up on us and become astonishingly difficult to solve. If I am not thoroughly convinced, there's no need for the grace, the glory, the beauty, the warm blanket of step two. And what is step two? It's restored to principled living. And so I'm in that hospital, and I remember I give birth to my daughter, and I named her Serenity. I named her Serenity because I just wanted peace. I didn't know anything about AA. I come from a world of hustlers. What we say is what it is. My dad was a pimp. Sounds so harsh. Manager. My dad was a manager, and so were his brothers. And so when you come from this background, I had to unlearn so much. I have had to unlearn so much. I'm so grateful to the women that have come here, that have gotten their dignity back and allowed themselves to heal in a way that they were not threatened by other women. They could just love and embrace other women. That's my role as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, my one friend. I don't know these people here. And so, anyway, you know, my daughter's never been in my life. When I came home, she didn't come home with me. She shook in my arms because she was detoxing. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the opportunity to heal and to be a positive influence in the lives of so many other people. I do a lot of things outside of AA as well. One of them is I volunteer at Covenant House, a homeless shelter for homeless and trafficked youth, 18 to 24, right? I take panels into jails. I take panels into a rehab with women and children. But I want to share this before I sit down. You know, when my daughter finds me, she'll find a woman that she's not ashamed of. She'll find a woman of dignity, of value, of courage, of self-worth, right? And one time I went to talk in Laconia, Washington, and this is the last thought. When they invited me, every time I go someplace, my host will share nice things about wherever the town is, whether it's London or LaConner, and she said, this guy, he goes, hundreds and thousands of people come from all over to walk through these tulips. So as we're driving, there's fields of tulips, all these vibrant, and I mean, fields of tulips. And so I guess he got inspired and he looked at me and he goes, do you want to walk through the tulips? And I thought, no, right? But before I said anything, spot check inventory. You know what I found? It wasn't that I didn't want to walk through the tulips. I was 18 years sober at the time. It's not that I didn't want to walk through the tulips. Even though I've done so many fabulous, wonderful firsts, and a woman like me doesn't get firsts, but AA has given them to me. The default is always a woman like you doesn't get to do things like that. That's for the refined woman. But AA said, say yes to your life. Say yes to new experiences. So I said, you know what? Yes, I would love to walk through the tulips. And I walked through the tulips. I had 5.5-inch heels because no one told me we were walking through the tulips, but I walked through them when they invited me back a year later. I said, are we going to the tulips? I got my shoes. You know what I mean? Because what used to be inconceivable is now a way of life. How do I become? By doing. You took me from alleys. And now I'm walking through tulips. That is my wish for you. Thank you.
That was so powerful. Let's give her a round of applause.